And I thought, you know, these guys have thrown bricks and bottles at each other throughout their childhood. But I remember just looking at them thinking, it's quite interesting. You put these young people into a shared social context, suddenly there's an engagement there.
You're listening to Pubcast Worldwide. Greetings, thirsty listeners, and welcome to this episode of Pubcast Worldwide, the podcast where we get to know interesting people around the world, chatting with them over beers, cocktails, and other libations at the coolest pubs, bars, and breweries on the planet. I'm your host, Chris Lukey, a serial event planner, fan of Irish punk rock, and an avid supporter of a properly poured Guinness. This is a bit of a heavier episode than what we normally do. Today, we are heading to Northern Ireland, where we'll be chatting with history teacher turned tour guide, Paul Donzo Donnelly. Donzo is a guide at Dead Center Tours, which is the number one walking tour in Belfast. And in this episode, the conversation is largely centered around the Troubles in Northern Ireland. This is arguably one of the biggest nationalist conflicts of the last century, but there's no better guide for this discussion than Donzo. So, what are the three things you can expect from today's episode? Well, first, Donzo's going to give us some background on the conflict in Northern Ireland, known as the Troubles, and how it shaped the Belfast and Northern Ireland of today. This is probably a good time to mention that Donzo's involvement in the evolving peace in Northern Ireland goes beyond history and tour guiding. He's also served as a mediator of conversations between people, including former inmates on both sides of the Troubles. He knows and has seen a lot. So, if you're only partially familiar with the conflict between the Loyalists and Republicans in Northern Ireland, don't worry, Donzo's got the baseline information for you to start things off. To be honest, it took me a bit of extra time to prepare for this interview because this was largely a learning experience for me as well. I mean, I had a lot of questions going into this interview where even my research hadn't given me a full picture. Like, is this a conflict about religion? Or, even when things have improved, why are there still physical signs of the division present throughout Belfast, like peace walls that still separate Loyalist Protestant and Republican Catholic neighborhoods? These are questions that Donzo helps us answer in this episode. There are things that might surprise you about how life has changed in Northern Ireland since the ceasefire in the 90s, but Donzo does an excellent job summarizing the history and how the peace process is an evolution, not a revolution. Kind of an overarching theme throughout this episode. All right, I know it took a while, but on that note, the second thing you'll get from this episode is the stories. Donzo has a lot of examples of how this evolution is taking place and how engagement between Loyalists and Republicans in Belfast has changed. You'll hear a lot of these anecdotes in the second half of this episode, with plenty of good takeaways to go with them. Finally, you'll hear about traveling to Northern Ireland and maybe even enjoy Belfast even more than Dublin. You'll hear about Belfast's counterculture and pubs, one of which was the setting for today's show. I was lucky enough to link up with Donzo fairly last minute on my last Europe trip, and we met up at the Garrick Bar in Belfast's city center. Picture a really old, urban Irish bar with bantering locals and lots of Guinness, and you've got yourself the Garrick Bar. Before we head to Belfast, I want to give a quick shout-out to our sponsor for this episode, Tortuga Backpacks. Tortuga is a boutique luggage company that makes some of the best carry-on backpacks for any travel junkie around. I personally use the Tortuga Outbreaker bag on a regular basis, which is the max size bag that will fit in an overhead bin. Their sleek but subtle designs make them perfect for both business and adventure travel, and because you're a listener of this fine show, you can get a 10% discount on your order using the code PUBCAST at checkout. And if you need any more proof that these bags are legit, just head on to episode 2 where we chat with Tortuga's co-founder, Fred Parada, over some brews. All right, thirsty listeners, you've listened to me quite long enough for this intro. Take a stroll down to the pub, grab a pint of Guinness, and as they say in Ireland, prepare yourself for some good crack with Donzo. Belfast, here we come. Ignore the boss, never home. All right, well, we're here in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and we've got quite the perfect pub setting, but that's just my impression. Can you describe where we're at right now?
We're in the Garrick Bar, which is right in the center of Belfast, a couple of hundred meters from the City Hall, so it really is central. Mm-hmm. It's an old Victorian building. It's been operational as a bar since 1870.
Yeah.
You know, so it's quite a pedigree there. And you're looking around dark wooden walls. We're sitting beside a lovely coal fire. Mm-hmm. It's a proper traditional Belfast bar. There's quite a lot of decor in it, but it's fairly eclectic. As you can see, some of it at the minute pertains to rugby because of the Six Nations. Mm-hmm. So it's a bar at the weekends. It's got a very regular daily clientele, but at the weekends, particularly with soccer and rugby, it would have quite a sporting crowd.
Okay.
And we've got horse racing from Cheltenham in the front bar this week. So there's an eclectic mix of just local ordinary punters, your professionals at the weekend who are unwinding, great food, and your sports fans who are down for a clatter of pints and a bit of shouting and entertainment.
I feel like it's probably quieter right now than it normally is during some of these sporting scenarios you're talking about. And I guess you said 1870 was when this started? You know, in the States, that like qualifies as an old bar, but I feel like there might be other pubs around here that are also that might be even older than that. Is that a correct statement?
Discussion just before you came in.
Yeah.
There's a bar, McHugh's, says it's Belfast's oldest building, 1711.
Uh-huh.
There's a new bar, the Dirty Onion, but it claims that part of the structure of this current bar was actually been there since 1680.
Okay.
There's another one, White's Tavern. They say it's been the site of a bar since 1630, but not always White's Tavern.
Yep.
So we're having this sort of competition at the minute. And then there's another bar, a very famous bar, associated with sort of Republican plots in the late 1700s called Kelly's Cellars. And some people say it's actually the oldest proper functional bar. The whole building has always been a bar.
Yeah.
So it's how do you define a bar?
Yep.
You know, and we can split hairs over this.
I've heard people go into the technicalities of that in terms of, you know, longest running bar, ones that are functional, or like you said, just like part of the building was a bar.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you have some very interesting bar chat here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Here in Belfast. So. And we didn't cheers it up yet.
No, we didn't.
Cheers. Thank you so much for joining on the show.
Very well. Thank you.
And the only proper way to start a pubcast in Ireland is with a Guinness, I must say.
Absolutely.
And is it just a rumor that the Guinness tastes better over here? I feel like I get a bit more from it when I'm over here instead of in the States, but that just might be the ambiance that kicks in as well.
It's a bit like what's the oldest bar in Belfast sort of debate. Some people will say, yes, it's definitely best within Ireland because that's where it's brewed and it doesn't have to travel and go through any disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
Though Guinness is produced in places like Nigeria and apparently is completely different and far, far stronger.
Oh, wow.
In terms of its alcohol content.
Yeah.
And then you'll get an internal debate. Is it better in Belfast or is it better in Dublin?
Mm.
And that's really getting down to an issue of intercity rivalry, maybe than the aesthetics of beer. I was in Donegal last year in January and I had a pint of Guinness and I was really looking forward to a pint of Guinness in Donegal and I was incredibly disappointed.
Oh, really?
Incredibly. And now I don't know whether it was just a fluke, but I was gulled.
Is there a Guinness brewery up here in Belfast also?
No, there's not.
Okay.
There used to be. There used to be a big Guinness depot. My grandfather actually worked in it. He was one of the keg delivery men.
Okay.
And that was in the days where there were no drink driving laws.
Uh-huh.
So they were served a pint of Guinness at every bar they went into to do a delivery.
Mm-hmm.
So he might have come home from work and have had 8 pints of Guinness in his working day.
Yeah.
He would then have his dinner and he'd have a wash. He would freshen up and he would go out to the pub for a drink.
Yeah.
Even though he'd actually been drinking all day via his employment.
Well, it's funny you bring that up. I think we've got something in common because my grandfather, being someone from St. Louis, him and all his brothers used to work for Anheuser-Busch in the brewery back when they were coming up. And they, I believe they were also doing deliveries and distribution as well. Well, for those of you listening today, we've got an exciting show and an exciting guest. I'm joined by Paul Donzo Donnelly of Dead Center Tours.
Yep.
So you are not only a tour guide, but you're quite the historian as well as a result of that.
Well, I'm actually a qualified history teacher by background. I taught history for a lot of years in adult and community education. Qualified mediator. I've done mediation work between loyalist and Republican communities in conflict. I've worked on dialogue projects facilitating conversations between loyalist and Republican ex-prisoners, guys who for 30 years or more prepared to kill each other. Now sitting in the same rooms, talking about their motivations, their experiences, jail, etc., and where they are today in relation to the peace process, the political developments that have taken place here since 1994 in the ceasefires by the Republicans and then by the Loyalists. So I took all those partial skills and fused them into becoming a tour guide, talking about these things, talking about obviously the nature of this place in terms of the politics, the history and the violence, mm-hmm. but it also, the tour combines stuff around the influence of punk rock in Belfast in the late 1970s, sure. and lots of other just little quirks that make Belfast, Belfast.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested to hear about all those, and it's funny that you bring up punk rock. That always, I'm a ex-punk rocker, I should say, probably still have some of those vibes, yeah. but always seems to be a theme on this show, it feels uh-huh. like. But for those of you listening, you might be able to guess, we are going to talk quite a bit about Northern Ireland history today, in addition to how that shaped the Northern Ireland and the Belfast that we have today. So, you know, I know a number of people out there familiar with the Troubles and the history of Northern Ireland, but, you know, so we can set up maybe a bit of the context of the conversation, can you give us maybe a quick summary, 1 to 2 minutes, just so we've got a base of some of the questions that I'm going to be asking around, you know, the Troubles and how those have shaped the Ireland that we have today?
I mean, again, you're going to always have a different analysis about mm-hmm. how they came about, depending who you talk to. Mm-hmm. You talk to Republicans, they see the problems here as being what they call the British presence on the Isle of Ireland for 800 mm-hmm. years. They say that the partition of Ireland in 1921 into two different states, the Republic of Ireland, which effectively left the United Kingdom,
yep.
Northern Ireland, as the predominantly Protestant part of the island, remains within the United Kingdom right. because of those historical links. They see that as undemocratic. And unjust, and they said that needs to be reversed and the British link broken mm-hmm. for the Unionist Protestant community. The preservation of Northern Ireland is essential. They mm-hmm. say that there were essentially two different nationalities on this island, the British mm-hmm. or the Scots-Irish, and then the other Irish. One group was Catholic, one group was Protestant.
Yep.
As a minority on the island, on the whole island, going mm-hmm. back to the 1600s, mm-hmm. the Protestant community feel that their British identity needs to be preserved within Northern Ireland, having its mm-hmm. British link. They say mm-hmm. if that's taken away, their Britishness will be suppressed by a dominant Irish identity. And as Protestants, many of them felt very wary of what they saw as a dominant conservative Catholic church mm-hmm. in Irish society, which had eroded their civil liberties. So mm-hmm. that was basically the contest of the two blocks, Britishness and Irishness on the island of Ireland.
Yep.
Northern Ireland comes about as a result of that. And it's where we are today. For 50 years, Northern Ireland was ruled by one party, the Unionist Party.
Mm-hmm.
Catholic community said they were discriminated against. Mm-hmm. They demanded reform of the state in Northern Ireland via civil rights movement, a bit like the US mm-hmm. in the 60s. And many in the Protestant community, not all, but many said, this isn't about reform of the state, housing, jobs, votes. This mm-hmm. this will be a push for a united Ireland. And then when a new IRA emerged in 1969, the Provisionals, mm-hmm. this confirms to the Protestants their fears. It was never about reform of Northern Ireland. It was about creating a united Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And we enter a phase of bloody conflict involving the yep. British Army,
mm-hmm.
the local police, overwhelmingly Protestant,
mm-hmm.
The Republican groupings, particularly the Provisional IRA and mm-hmm. the Loyalist groups. So you have a very myriad, complex number of conflicts within conflicts.
Right.
But in 1994, you know, we're a pretty exhausted place.
Mm-hmm.
And people decide to experiment with ceasefire. Now mm-hmm. there are breaches of it. It breaks down significantly by the IRA in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
It's restored in 1997. And then we enter a period of intense political dialogue,
mm-hmm.
which brings about the Belfast or Good Friday Agreement in 1998.
Yep.
You know, supported by the British and Irish governments, very much supported by the US administrations, particularly the Clintons.
Mm-hmm.
Senator George Mitchell from Maine was the chairperson of the talks process.
Mm-hmm.
And we end up with the agreement, which has been, for better or for worse, our sort of governing document for the last 20 years. Now,
right.
at the minute we have a problem. The power sharing between Republicans and Unionists, they shared power and government together, mm-hmm. has broken down. So we have a political void there. Mm-hmm. But in the past, traditionally, nearly classically, where we had a political crisis, you saw an increase in political violence.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably, that hasn't happened in the last year plus. You know,
yeah.
So I think in some ways we're in somewhere different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the past we did revert to violence. We have a political problem at the moment, but we haven't diverted the violence. We're trying
sure.
to work it out still through dialogue, even though it's incredibly complex and frustrating. Mm-hmm. I think we're arguably in a better place than we were between 1969 and 1994.
And I'm going to dig into a couple of those comments as we go through the discussion on that. I guess one thing you hinted at right at the end of that is that you are in a better place than you were at the 94 mark. You know, what are some of the things, and this probably goes into some of the areas where you've talked with groups and had some of those mediating discussions that you've mentioned, ex-prisoners. How have you seen the change over time? And just like you said, in the past couple of years, most recently, what are some signs that really show that things are moving forward, if that's the right way to describe it?
I mean, there's lots of different indicators. Unemployment levels, which were traditionally quite high, are much lower than before. It's not to say we're an incredibly wealthy society. You know, by Western European standards, we're not. We have a big reliance on the public sector. A lot of our old traditional industries, shipbuilding, heavy engineering, which we were very famous for, you know, virtually disappeared from the economic landscape. So there's a lot of change economically, but that was always happening. But what we do now have, well, a very obvious example, obviously it applies to me, would be tourism.
Yeah.
Tourism here is, at the minute, they are frantically trying to build hotels in Belfast because they haven't got enough rooms for the demand. We've had to build a new dock. A new docking area for the cruise ships coming into Belfast.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's stuff that wasn't there 5-10 years ago. You can now see it on the streets. And it's not just in the summer. I mean, we're sitting here in March. I mean, I've had two groups out today. A group from Denmark, a group from the United States. Yesterday I had people from Denmark before. These were, I mean, people from the States would always come here in terms of background, the Irish diaspora. But large groups of people from Denmark, Sweden, you know, right across the globe, didn't come here. And why would they? It wasn't safe.
Sure.
So there's something you can see on the streets. You can hear the foreign voices in the pubs every day. You know, so that's massive.
Yeah. What are, I was going to ask this later, but I think this is a good time for it. What do you find people are looking to get from your tours, whether they're coming from Denmark, the United States, or maybe local folks that are on your tour as well? Is there a learning experience they're trying to get? How would you sum that up?
There's lots of different sort of reasons for that. You'll have school groups coming from the Republic of Ireland and from England because it's now on their curriculum. You know, they're studying about it in school, so this is an opportunity to get outside the dry textbook and actually engage the environment and hear somebody local talking about experiences. You know, it gives them a much richer sense in their learning. You have people who are here in personal journeys, people whose maybe father served here in the British Army, and they're coming over to find out, what did my father do? You know, because he didn't talk about it. You know, he'd say somebody who died, and they often wondered, but you know, obviously he went through something potentially traumatic. He was involved in things that may have been contentious. They're trying to piece together jigsaws. And we've had former British soldiers. We've had former combatants do the tour, Royalist and Republican. You know, they want to hear how we're presenting it, you know, as a diet. You know, they have a scrutiny about them. You have to be very careful. But also, they're revisiting. They're revisiting something that they were engaged in from a different perspective. Not just their own perspective, but hearing what other people in the city around them think about. So lots of different motivations. Some are incredibly emotional. We don't actually have a huge amount of engagement with locals. I mean, there are plenty, but it's visitors. It's primarily visitors. And I'm talking all around the globe. People from Chile, Japan, Syria, Malta. You know, it's, at the beginning, we anticipated the American audience, the Canadians, the Australians, all the diaspora connections. People from England, Scotland, Wales, and the Republic of Ireland. But we have been quite surprised at the sheer variety. And an inter-European difference. Lots of North Europeans, Scandinavians, Dutch, Danish, you know, a large clattering of Germans, although it's a large country. Very few people from Spain and Italy, Portugal, you know, Southern Europeans. And I think it's a cultural difference. They're not as into organized tours. Whereas the more organized Northern Europeans.
That. They're more into nightlife, staying out late and whatnot. They're not going to be up early enough for organized tours. it's interesting because it sounds like learning, whether it's someone, you know, coming from a totally outside perspective or some of the anecdotes you've mentioned, someone that had some sort of engagement or connection to it are coming to learn from it. How would you say locals are trying to learn from this or working together to come through some of these previous conflicts? Is that taking place? Are there discussions like this taking place at pubs where both groups are more engaged in conversations right now? I don't want to be naive to this, but it's a question I feel I have to ask.
Well, funny, in the introduction to my city centre tour, one of the things I do specifically address is that as a society, although we still have very strong patterns of segregation and housing and schooling and other areas, we are becoming better at having conversations in shared company and in shared space. However, sometimes some of the things that we did, particularly in the 70s, the early days of the Troubles to each other. Mm-hmm. And when you raise it in that mixed company, you can nearly feel people going, whoa, backing away, it's too soon, we're still too raw.
Yeah.
You know, this is a very gradual process, very gradual process. I mean, we have Dietz said earlier on, 8 centuries of problems if you're a Republican with the English, certainly 4 centuries of problems between Protestants and Catholics on the island generally. That's very deeply ingrained. That's very much in the psyche of individuals, entire communities. And it doesn't just evaporate overnight because you have a relative lack of violence for 25 years, you know. So quite often today I was standing at the huge peace walls in West Belfast and people are saying, why are they there? And I make the comparison talking about the Berlin Wall. So in the Berlin Wall, West Belfast Peace Wall and its various shapes and constructs has been there longer than the Berlin Wall, an international symbol of, you know, division. That's come down. But ours, they came down in part of a very, very quick and spontaneous revolution, in a sense. Whereas we're not having a revolution here. We're having an evolution. This thing is so deep that it's not going to be a magic wand waved one day and we all wake up and we're, oh, it's over.
Yeah.
And there will always be residual evidence of it. I think generations away from now, you will still have subtle differences between the attitudes of nationalists and unionists and many Protestants and Catholics.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up because, you know, in preparing for this, I know there are still a lot of signs around the city, and especially the Peace Wall being one of the most physical presences of, I guess, the division that is an evolution process. Like I said, it's not a revolution. It's not coming down overnight like they did in Berlin. So it sounds like those things are there, and that's still a part of the culture here, but people are moving forward beyond it. Would you say the younger generation is helping with those kind of discussions? Because I've heard some mixed things about their impact in this.
Well, I'm glad you've heard mixed things about that, because I think there's a bit of realism needed here. Young people are not immune to this. They didn't have to be here to have views about it. They come from families and communities where much of this stuff can be intergenerational. You know, stuff will be talked about that happened to family in the 1920s or in the 1880s, you know, and that lore is handed down. So those kids aren't immune. There are some kids who don't give a crap. You know, it hasn't impacted upon them. They don't get it. They're not interested in it. But you'll have kids from some communities and backgrounds who still are very aware of it. And I've worked in both state schools, which are predominantly Protestant, in the Catholic-maintained sector. And I've met kids who've asked me and said things to me like, Paul, it must have been really exciting. I think there was a glamour. There was a buzz. They also think there was a valour and an honour, you know, defending your community, fighting the IRA, fighting the British Army, you know, and they think they missed out on something. So there's a romanticisation there sometimes and a certain naivety.
I found that so interesting when I stumbled upon that because, you know, I think typically, whether it's the millennial generation, people in their late 20s, early 30s, younger than that, there's this perception that they have this automatic inclusive mentality. But with what you're saying is there are elements of this that have been romanticized, which was, for me, very, very surprising. While we're on this topic, what is something that people that are learning about the Troubles, learning about the evolution, that you wish more people knew about? Maybe an element that's often passed by that's a very significant piece of it, but just does not get the attention of some of the more surface-level topics.
Well, I think if there's a process where it's being romanticized, I don't think kids are being romanticized in the sense of the human misery was acceptable. You know, they're being romanticized about the glory of the cause and all. It's the broader visionary ideas.
And defending your ideals and your family's ideals, things like that.
I think the darkness of what happened here has to be emphasized. Now, that's quite challenging because you could get into just horrible voyeuristic descriptions of atrocities. You know, it's really like conflict porn for some people, and I think you really need to avoid that because, like, ethically, it's wrong.
Yeah.
However, finding that balance where you can get through to people that sense what a difficult place it was to live, the levels of fear, how you were restricted physically and psychologically, you know, from moving around certain places, you know, having to bypass certain streets in order to gain access to a shop. You know, all the impacts that it had on making life incredibly difficult and wearing people down. I think that's quite important. And I think that's one of the things, certainly in terms of our feedback and our reviews, in terms of our tour, that we have had a degree of success in bringing about. not being sensationalist and dark, you know, in that gruesome sense, but conveying a sense of how difficult it was, you know, and how tragic it frequently was. Mm-hmm. So we have a structure of actual events based on very, very firm research, coroner's reports, police deposition papers, media interviews with people who were witness and present at the time. So you've got that strong factual structure, but you're combined it with the stories of people who, you know, were victims, people who were perpetrators of violence. How did they come to be in those positions? And what impact did it have on their families, on their communities? You know, so it's factual balance, factual accuracy, and a narrative very often based on storytelling, which helps to convey the bigger picture, the bigger experience.
When you're having these conversations with people, when you're leading your tours, or when in the past when you've mediated discussions, what are the aha moments that you see from people?
When the moments of revelation or enlightenment? Or
Yeah, exactly. If you can share those.
Well, there's probably so many of them that they're now, it would be hard to cut and paste and edit one quickly. Certainly I remember having an aha moment one time and facilitating a dialogue between loyalist and Republican ex-prisoners. And Republicans were challenging about a certain type of loyalist violence, or the violence of a certain grouping. The Shankill Butchers, essentially, who many people still view as just simply being psychotic. And there was a very difficult strain in the conversation. A controversial statement that had been made by one of the Republicans about loyalist sectarianism. And the loyalists accepted one of the Republican points about the sectarianism and the nature of the Shankill Butchers, but also pointed out that it was the butchers' behaviour was apparent, but also that they didn't do loyalism any favours because it made the world look at loyalism and see it simply as a sectarian thuggery, a sectarian psychosis. And he pointed out, remember, they also killed other loyalists and Protestants, so they hurt their own community as well. Now, it didn't dissuade the Republicans of the acute sectarianism, but they hadn't considered the impact that the butchers also had in their own communities, how people lived in fear of them as well. You know, so that was a progression. You know, people weren't diluting their views, but they were adding to them. And that's part of what this process is about.
It sounds like any good political discussion in a lot of ways. Maybe you're not going to change an opinion, maybe you're not going to totally see eye to eye, but you're going to recognize some things that allow you to see from the other perspective a bit more as you gain more facts.
Yeah, I've always used that term. They didn't dilute their own politics, but they had a greater understanding of the politics of the other. You know, and that form of dialogue where you have different layers of understandings being added to you, I think is more likely to produce something healthy in terms of managing those difficult relationships.
Yeah. Now, we've talked a bit, very much in terms of the troubles before, during, and after, but what are some things that you've seen culturally, whether it's food, music, beer, or maybe as an example, that are bringing people together?
Here's a very simple example. People here enjoy coming into the city centre, the pubs, to 1 o'clock at night. Because it used to be virtually hard for a long period, hardly any opened after six at night. There was an incredibly restricted social life. You know, so having that freedom of movement and that freedom, you know, that sense of being in a comfort zone by being in a bar like this, which would have a very mixed clientele. Guys sitting in the evening from different backgrounds, communities, in a way that they simply weren't able to do or had very limited opportunities to do for two, 3 decades. That's a big plus. That's a real big plus in people's lives. The fact now that we have really, really good restaurants. This always amused me on my tours and earlier, people said, and the food has been superb. And I remember downtown Belfast where there was like a couple of burger bars. I remember there was a terrible Italian pasta and pizza restaurant where the owner was completely abusive to his staff and customers, but it was the only place of its type. So people queued to get in. And you could bring your own wine, and it was like this oasis. And now that wouldn't be tolerated. So you've huge number of great restaurants. There's constantly places open, and it's not just for the tourist trade coming in. Local people enjoy it. Local people benefit of it. Local people are employed in it. You know, so there's two immediate examples.
Perfect. Sorry, I was just taking one last sip of my Guinness. Well, we're going to take a quick pause here in the interview for a round two. I've got a little bit of Guinness left, and I know you've been doing most of the talking, so you probably got a little catching up. But for those of you listening, we're going to be right back.
control you, and that's a lie, you know. They say you will never be free, free, free.
I've got one pint in me, you've got two, mm-hmm. So that brings up the tipsy talk
the
portion
tipsy
of the
talk.
Show. So, well, let's start with the cheers again, since we've got some fresh Guinness in front of us.
Cheers.
Cheers. I didn't know why I was thinking I'd drink anything but Guinness in this interview. It's like you're coming to Ireland, you gotta jump into the basics, and I do think it is better here. Maybe it's just because this is my second one, and it's starting to flow.
The warmth
more,
is moving through.
Exactly, and it's not just the fire that's right next to us. This is the first time I've done one of these right next to a fire, but.
Yeah.
This is pretty authentic. And we were chatting during the break, because I mentioned to you about the drinking story, but you had a pretty cool anecdote about a little detour in your career you were doing when you weren't doing history and you weren't doing tours.
Yeah.
You said you were a doorman, I believe.
I got sort of burnt out by the political and education scene. It was very intensive. And I walked away and got a job, was offered a job working full-time as a doorman in a different pub in the city centre, another very well-known Belfast bar.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that full-time for between 3 and 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the period after the ceasefires and actually leading up to the Good Friday Agreement. So it was a very intensive political period.
Sure.
But you could see lots of social changes going on in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And people were starting to come out of their old neighbourhoods. You know, people stayed in their safe zones.
Yeah.
And I remember doing the door and say IDing young guys to make sure they're the right age and checking their addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one night looking and there was a group of kids that come in from the Shankill estate, and I know it well because my grandmother lived there.
Yep.
But it's loyalist.
Yeah.
There was also a group of kids coming from the New Lodge, and I know it too because I had family there and it's Republican.
Yep.
And there have been two areas which would have had an interface, a lot of violence between them.
Mm-hmm.
So this realisation, and I was one of the charge hands. And I thought, I'm going to go upstairs. They're all gone up to the disco up on the top floor.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, these guys have thrown bricks and bottles at each other throughout their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up and they were actually standing, talking to each other.
Yeah.
They suddenly were in a shared space in the city centre, in a social scene.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't, you know, a road through which over to throw missiles. There was certainly no police presence, you know, to actually stop them, pursue them and arrest them. So they were suddenly stuck with this realisation. What are we going to do? Are we going to fight on the dance floor and get thrown out of the club?
Yeah.
Or are we going to stand and talk to each other?
Yeah.
And we stood and talked to each other. And I remember just having that moment. Now, that's not to say...
That's awesome.
You know, there's situations where things didn't go so well. But I remember just looking at them thinking, it's quite interesting. You put these young people in this shared social context.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, there's an engagement there.
Mm-hmm.
There was an engagement previously.
Yeah.
It was bricks and bottles and fists, you know. This was suddenly a different engagement. And I remember thinking, this wouldn't be possible without ceasefires. They wouldn't have been here in the first place, never mind having to reassess how they interact with each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because in the first half of the interview, you mentioned how just pub life in general has brought people together into the same spot. Now you've got a specific anecdote around that. And, you know, to a large extent, that's why I started a pubcast, because it's like, hey, the best time to have a conversation is to have a conversation over a beverage in a shared space.
Yeah.
So I love that. I think that adds another element to everything we've been talking about. But you hinted at this at the end of the first half as well. There's a lot more to Belfast, including the food, the culture, the music scene. What's something that when people come here don't know exists here that people should know about, like a pretty badass thing to experience in Belfast?
That's a real challenger.
Okay.
And this may be a generational thing. Like, I'm 49 now. I'll be 50 this year.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter will be 26 this month.
Okay.
She would probably turn around and say something that I'd go, really?
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
My son is be turning 12.
Yeah.
In a couple of months' time. He may have a completely different take.
Sure.
You know, in terms of, I wonder sometimes, am I so immersed in all this stuff to do with the past?
Mm-hmm.
What I am very aware of, and again, it's back to the pub culture, very often, I remember in the past, my daughter's about 16, saying to her one night, what are you doing tonight? And she said, well, I was going to this venue, the Black Box.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what does it do? And she said, oh, it's like open mic night. We never had anything like that before.
Really?
You know, yep, never had anything like
that.
Okay. Sort of indie culture, counterculture.
Yeah.
And I said, God, that sounds really good. Where is it? And she told me the name of the street. And I went, and I knew the street historically. And I just went, you're joking. You cannot go down there.
Yeah.
That is just not a safe place to be. And she was just looking at me going, you sad old man, what are you talking about? It's one of the hip places to be.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that sort of counterculture stuff, we now have an event called Culture Week, and it's based around the city centre. It's not a counterculture to the Republican festivals or the Loyalist marches. It's just an expression of a vibrancy. I had a friend who grew up in Belfast. He's actually a day older than me.
Okay.
And he grew up, and he now lives in Canada. Worked in the drinks trade, so he knew Belfast pretty intimately.
Yeah.
He was home last year, and he was just walking around parts of the city centre at night time going, what happened here?
Yeah.
It was just so utterly different, you know. So, and it's things like Culture Week, which are promoted and advertised. So maybe they're not under the radar, but they're very, very new. They're very different to what we previously had. And you still have the old, you know, that you have the Loyalist band scene, you have the sort of the Republican, you know, the more traditional Irish sort of cultural stuff, the Cayley Sessions, the West Belfast Festival.
Yeah.
And I think they're all legitimate. They all have, because they're all part of the fabric of this city. They're all part of what made Belfast what it is, and they're manifestations of Belfast and many of its sort of older traditions. But you now have stuff going on which is more, it's more secular, it's more Western European.
Yeah.
You know, you could be in Frankfurt, you could be in Malmo, but you're not, you're in Belfast.
That's pretty rad. It sounds like you're learning something new about the city every day too. It just sounds like it's changing very dynamically as well too, where your kids are keeping you in tune with some of the new things that are that are popping up.
Yeah, they keep me grounded.
Well, you know, you mentioned the counterculture as well. I do have a personal question for you, and it's also a biased question because I'm such a punk rock junkie. How did that influence, you know, what you do with the tours and, I guess, the way you've approached your life so far?
There's a specific part of the tour in an area called Hill Street. It's now a government office, but it used to be the site of the old Harp Bar. There's a new Harp Bar, which is very gentrified and tourist-orientated.
Yep.
The old punk bar, you know, was a... physically it was a dive. The masonry was falling off the front. It had a huge security cage on the front, and lots of our bars had those to protect clientele. You know, there were electric mechanisms to prevent people getting through the cages. It was always traditionally a Catholic dock workers bar, but in the late 1970s a guy called Terry Hooley, who's sort of seen as the godfather of Belfast punk, he started to use it as a venue to promote bands like Stiff Little Fingers, the Undertones, some lesser known bands, Rudy, the Outcasts, who actually won a sort of award one time as the best punk band in Europe, but they're from Belfast. And it created a counterculture for that time of people from Catholic and Protestant backgrounds, young people, really for the first time in their lives having positive social engagement with the other, because punk provided that opportunity. You think of the philosophy of punk, defying the old orthodoxies and hierarchies, throwing away the rule book. And they brought, those bands came, like the Undertones were from the Republican bog site. The Defects were a big band. They were from the Tullycarnock, a big UDA-controlled Loyalist estate in East Belfast. And they're bringing their fans all along to the same venue, you know, and they're doing their punk stuff. They're spitting on each other, they're pogoing. It's got all that apparent violence of punk.
Yeah.
But it was punk violence, it wasn't sectarian violence. And I know guys who grew up in extremely contested communities who threw, particularly the Harp Bar, developed lifelong friendships that defied their previous experience, you know. And again, no magic wand, no panacea to all our ills, but there were social relationships created in those in that venue and in that atmosphere, which totally defied the dynamic of what was happening in an intensely sectarian, polarized city at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and so there is that movie, Good Vibrations, celebrating the punk scene in Belfast because it was something utterly different.
I need to see that. I haven't seen that. I've heard of that movie. Yeah. I haven't seen it before. It's is that a favorite of yours? Or is it a good one that you'd recommend for people who want to...
I actually haven't seen it.
Oh, really? Okay, right? Okay. So we're in the same boat.
I was meant to be an extra in it, but I actually got drunk and never made it.
Well, there's your drinking story right there.
And that's a punk story and it's atmosphere, you know. But what I do know is I get lots of people coming here from all around the world who have seen that movie. And it was one of the reasons they wanted to come to Belfast, because they found it fascinating.
I'll have to check it out. I mean, Stiff Little Fingers, as a punk rock fan, like everyone's heard of those guys.
Well, they had the anthem, Alternative Ulster, you know, and that really summed up the frustrations of so many young people that time about just basically how crap the city was.
Yeah.
If you wanted entertainment, you had to walk outside to a town called Bangor. And then you had to walk home again. It was about 16 miles. There was just so little in Belfast for young people.
It's a hike.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about Belfast specifically, but I want to bring Ireland into this conversation for a second. You know, because when people travel here, a lot of times they'll go to Dublin, they'll go to Galway. They might not make it up to Belfast in Northern Ireland. What's one thing that Northern Ireland does really well versus the rest of Ireland that you might not be able to get when you're down down in the south?
Well, one of the things I think, although the political violence has abated considerably, it's still an edgy city in some ways. You know, you still do have peace lines, you still do have demarcations of areas, and that's fascinating for people.
Yeah.
Now, it's maybe not necessarily a good thing, but say, element of self-promotion, they see a peace line and then they come in our city centre to her and they say, right, so what's happening out there and what's happening here and why is it at this stage?
Yeah.
You know, you don't have that in the rest of Ireland because Galway's Galway. There's no contested history. Dublin's a very historical city. But all that history has basically been addressed. It's in a completely different place.
Yeah.
Belfast is a city in transition.
Yeah.
Northern Ireland is a place in transition. And that makes it a very engaging place to be.
Yeah.
You go on a historical walking tour in Dublin, it is historical.
It is historical.
You do a historical walking tour in Belfast, it's contemporary, evolving, living history.
Yeah.
You can feel it.
I felt it. I felt it when I got here. You know, you can. I was walking to my hostel right when I got off the bus, and there were, I'm trying to remember, was it Sandy Row? And I was walking by there, and it was very much struck me as a loyalist type neighborhood.
Yeah,
I saw
totally.
a lot of Union Jack flags there, so there is that dynamic. You can feel it just when you're here, and this is coming from the perspective of an outsider that's never been here before. But you know, much like a city like Berlin, or maybe like Medellin, Colombia, somewhere that's also coming out of its own recent history. You're right. There is a dynamic vibe here that says things are changing, and in my opinion, sounds like they're changing in the right direction.
Yeah, but you can also still have a sense of the, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was like.
Yeah, cool. That was I like the way you answered that. This is an interesting question. What is maybe something that's misunderstood about Northern Ireland?
I think, you know, again, some people may completely disagree with me. Some people's view is it a religious conflict? You know, is it Catholics and Protestants? Well, in a sense, it is, because historically it was. But it's also been a social and economic conflict. And ultimately, it's a conflict about identity, national identity, Britishness and Irishness, you know. You know, I know some people, particularly in the more conservative Protestant churches, who do see it as ultimately a religious showdown. You know, and the IRA are the manifestations of the old forces of Catholicism.
Yep.
But I know lots of loyalists and Republicans who are actually very secular. You know, some who are atheists, some who are agnostic. But it hasn't diluted their Irishness or their Britishness.
Yeah.
So essentially, it's about national identity. It's no longer a religious war. You know, very few people are saying, you know, if you stop a Protestant 20-year-old young lad on the Shankill Road and said, what's your objection to the Catholic Mass?
Yeah.
He probably wouldn't have a clue what you're talking about.
Sure.
But if you ask him to explain his British identity, he'd be very strong about it.
Yeah.
You know, so that concept of the religious war is outdated.
Well, it was interesting as I was preparing for this, my question to myself was, I'm like, is this a religious conflict? Is it a political conflict? There were multiple layers of it where it's like, how do you decipher what it is? So, and like you're saying, it sounds like it's a conflict of identity, figuring out what that looks like. A couple of wrap-up questions here as we get to the end. What do you feel like the rest of the world can learn from Northern Ireland and how you've gone through this?
The big thing is, in terms of resolution, and again, it's not a panacea to all our ills, and I've always been very consistent about this, but you're never going to have a resolution unless you have dialogue. And ultimately, all disputes, unless it's something like a localized disputes, so national disputes, they will always come to a dialogue. And I think sometimes combatants and antagonists should be aware that at some stage you will have a dialogue with your opposition. Okay, you'll have something global like the Second World War. It's going to end up in surrender, Nuremberg trials, you know, retributions. But ours, a conflict in a very small place, you're going to end up in dialogue. And I think if people feel, I cannot talk to them now, and you think you have to take up arms, be aware, but you will talk to them in the future.
Yeah, that's a great way to answer it. It's a really heavy way to answer it, but it's also it makes perfect sense as well, too. And if I look at, conflict is the wrong word, but a lot of the division in my own country, back home in the States right now, a lot of it revolves around a lack of dialogue and two groups that are unwilling to talk to one another. I think you sum that up very well. Last question for you before we do a little wrap-up. What's one question you wish I would have asked you that I did not?
Ah, That's a cracker.
Actually, I've got another question for you after that, based on how you answered that with that question being a cracker, because I've heard about good crack so far, and I don't necessarily totally know that term, but we'll get back to that in a second.
Right. Talked about punk, we talked about beer, talked about social scenes, obviously talked about the politics and the history of the conflict.
Yeah.
Sport in the society.
Oh, yeah,
we're sitting here under all this Irish rugby stuff.
Yeah,
you've got an English flag, a Welsh flag, you've got an Irish flag, Scottish flag. You know, say the Irish flag probably will, even during the rugby, not be flown in some bars in Belfast.
Okay.
Even though people may be supporting the Irish rugby team, because
it
represents all the rugby players in Ireland. For some, and like in unionist and loyalist communities, having the Irish flag in their bar wouldn't be acceptable.
Yeah.
So sport's an interesting one. In that local soccer would be quite religiously divided. Rugby tends to be more inclusive, though it tends to be historically, certainly in Northern Ireland, very few Catholic schools played rugby. Now that's starting to change. The state-struck Protestant schools played rugby. But rugby as a sport on an all-Ireland level is a great unifier. You know, many Protestants, very unionists, will more than happily travel to Dublin to support an all-Ireland rugby team.
Yeah.
Boxing, very working-class sport. In Belfast, always had very strong, you know, we produced a lot of good boxers, a lot of world champions, and even right up to today we've had people like Carl Frampton, who's from Taggart's Bay, very loyalist area. In the conflict period, young working class kids involved in boxing went to each other's communities to train together, to join the same clubs, you know, despite their communities being in conflict. And there was nearly an unwritten agreement between the paramilitaries that those kids would have safe passage in and out of those communities because they were involved in boxing.
Yeah.
So you have all these schisms around sport. It can be a great unifier.
Yeah.
And then it can be very divisive. It depends on the sport.
It's interesting.
It can depend on class, but there's no consistency on it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, if there's one thing that I've been learning from this conversation is, whether it's going to the same bar, supporting a sports team, punk rock, there's a lot of unifying elements of an area's culture that often allow people to look past some of the biggest dividers within a society. This has been very interesting for me.
I
really appreciate the conversation. Now, to kind of wrap things up, you know, we're hanging out here at Garrick.
The Garrick Bar.
But what are some other spots like around the area that if someone were to come to Belfast, it's like, these are some bars and restaurants that you've got to make sure you bounce to while you're here.
Yeah. One of the ones that people go to is the Crown Bar in Great Victoria Street. It's a beautiful old Victorian bar. It's owned by the National Trust. It's actually preserved. Beautifully ornate. Little booze, lovely stained glass. Visually, it's well worth visiting.
Okay.
My one quibble, and I don't think this is deflammatory in any way, is that they get 60% of the daily tourist footfall because they're owned by the National Trust. You know, they're preserved by a legal organization.
Sure.
They're Guinness.
Mm.
A bit sloppy.
Got it.
You know,
okay.
They're a bit casual.
Do you judge spots based on how they do their Guinness? Is that a front runner?
It's an important element. Yeah.
I would think so.
Yeah,
I would think
really
so.
I talked about that bar that I worked in, Lavery's.
Yep.
You know, I don't really go to it too much now. It's changed a lot. But again, back in the early, there was a period in the 80s where Lavery's was a melting pot. The districts around it were very Protestant and loyalist, but it also attracted, but again, it became another one that had a bit of a punk scene going on with it. When the Heart Bar closed, a lot of them moved up to Lavery's. But you would have had solicitors and teachers going into it after work. And again, just one of those wee melting pots. A little bit, somewhere a little bit different, you know. But certainly if you're in Belfast City Centre, I think the Garrick is just a classic example of a great bit. And the brilliant staff. Absolutely brilliant staff.
Yeah.
You know.
It's been lovely being here. It's been, the crew's been great. Serving us good drinks. Guinness well poured the whole time.
Absolutely.
It's been good. You know, I meant to go back to this. So good. Has this conversation been good? Good crack, as you'd say, as well. As, now, what is that term? Like, fill a Yankee in like myself really quickly.
Again, some people spell it crack.
Okay.
It's just crack.
You know,
and it just means banter, if that makes any sense to this audience. You know, a good, lively, spirited conversation, lots of humour, maybe sometimes a bit of sarcasm, a bit of edge. You heard me and my friend Brian having a very sarcastic conversation.
Yeah, no, it was
That's
great.
How we normally talk to each other on a habitual basis for three decades now. Some people say it's crack, and it's C-R-A-I-C, and it's actually an Irish word in origin.
Okay.
And recently, a few linguists had a dispute about it, saying actually crack, the Irish version, is an artificial construct, and it's the Gaelicisation of fun and humour. Mm-hmm. You know, so even though we've come a long way, even the simple understanding of what constitutes fun can still start to fall into a political debate and a linguistic debate.
Yeah.
You know, so, but then again, that's that age, that's that tension. It makes it interesting. It's certainly never going to be bland.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's as we wrap up, what is next for you and Dead Centre Tours?
We have lots of exciting projects. We've started to do an increased amount of work with schools in the Irish Republic, where we travel to them for the days. We're just about to launch a new church tour.
Okay.
Churches around the centre of Belfast of all the different faiths and denominations.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually hugely exciting because churches play a huge part in the history of this city.
Sure. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Mark Wiley, the Brains Pound outfit, he's working on a completely different technological project around historical sites, Grey Abbey and Leandrum, down in County Down. And that'll be a completely different visitor experience in terms of the use of technology for a visual accompaniment on ancient historical sites of what they could really look like at the time and a compelling historical narrative. So we're really set that we've got our city centre tour, the stuff that we do in West Belfast around the interfaces and the peace lines, and the tour like mine today in Inner East Belfast, which is just a geographical replication of the West Belfast one.
Yep.
And then one around churches. Never envisage us doing churches. But not places I spend a lot of time in, but fascinating and important. And then this completely different technological medium about a visual tour using technology to create what the past looked like.
So that is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And how do we connect with you guys? Social media, website, where's the best way to find you guys?
Well, we have our website.
Perfect.
But you think I would know the name of offhand.
Well, it's two beers in, you know.
Yeah, well,
that's true. It's a little later in the conversation.
It's www.deadcentretours.com. We have a Facebook page.
Okay.
We're also on TripAdvisor, and I would really advise people check us out on TripAdvisor.
Yep.
We are the number one walking tour in Belfast, and at the
minute
of 122 attractions in Belfast, we're currently rated number two.
Cool.
And we're a very small outfit. We're not the Titanic Centre. We're not a big taxi company.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very small outfit. But
yeah.
People just keep writing in about their experiences of us.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I will have links to all of those for all of you listening. I will have links to all of those in the show notes. So that way you know where to find Donzo and his tours. In the meantime, this has been an excellent conversation. Thank you so much for the crack today.
Right.
And
whichever way you spell it.
And for those of you listening, we will see you again next time. Hey, thanks for listening. That was Stiff Little Fingers with their song Alternative Ulster. Donzo made mention of them and this song specifically, so even with my bias towards punk rock music, there was no more perfect anthem to complement this episode. If you're going to Belfast, make sure to check out Dead Centre Tours, that's Centre spelled C-E-N-T-R-E. I've got links to them in the show notes, as well as some of the pubs and history that we discussed throughout the episode. I've got to give one last thanks to our sponsor this week, Tortuga Backpacks. And don't forget to take advantage of that discount code PUBCAST to get 10% off your order at checkout. Finally, make sure to head over to pubcastworldwide.com and leave a comment about this episode. I know this episode had a much more historical kick to it, and I'd be really interested to hear if you'd like to hear more episodes like this. While you're there, you can sign up for the Brews Letter, which is the newsletter I send out on a monthly basis, and another great way to keep in contact with me. With that, we've got some more international episodes on the horizon, as well as some U.S. East Coast episodes coming up. So stay thirsty, and I'll catch you here again soon. Cheers!